You know, our little community is kind of like God in the sense that we're, you know, we're quiet, we're unassuming. If you blink, you miss us. You know, it's kind of like that. Can you get your arms around that notion? Can you get your mind wrapped around that notion that God is an unassuming God? You know, this is something that is really hard for us to deal with in so many ways. We think of God as a creator of the universe, and he's on high, and he's magnificent, and he's holy, and he is all those things. But Jesus showed us that he also washes our feet. Jesus showed us that he stands at the height of a child, at the kneeling height of the servant. And so there's this other side to God that you would walk right past him if you weren't already sensitized to who he really is and watching for who he is. I remember a pastor getting up and saying, "I think today I want to talk about the Father's love. But then I always want to talk about the Father's love." And that's the way I am. You know, I know that I talk about the Father's love a lot, but I guarantee you it's the one thing that we need to get. If we can just get that one piece to understand the nature, the extent, the radical depth of the Father's love, it would change everything about our moments. It would change the way we approach everything. There are impediments, very real impediments, to us really apprehending, comprehending, or at least beginning to understand and experience this kind of love, this kind of radical, radical connection, unconditional acceptance and connection that is the good news that Jesus came to proclaim. And I want to talk about one of those impediments this morning. And I figure it's been a while since I've gotten myself into trouble, so I might as well go for it today, and we'll see how it goes. You know, you've heard about the third rail, you know, like in a electric car. There's the two rails on the outside. You're okay if you touch those, but then there's the third rail. You touch that, and you're toast, you know. The third rail in politics is Social Security, but there's a third rail in contemporary Christianity, and I'm going to touch on it today, and we'll see how we do. Or at least see how I do. In the last few weeks, we've been talking about this process that we need to go through in order to start to know God. How do we know God? How do we approach him? How is it that we can start to experience all that he is? We talked about that. We talked about becoming part of something that is larger than yourself. And the way that you do that is becoming smaller in yourself, to let the air out of your tires, to allow space for other people to enter your time zone, your world. And all of these things that we've been talking about, you know, are important, but there are blockages there, and we need to address those, and we need to start with the big ideas. The thing about our life is that we don't live on the mountaintop. We live in the valleys. Our days, if you really analyze them, are probably 85 to 90% just mundane everyday details, just the activities of daily life. You know, it's washing clothes and it's driving to work and it's doing all the things that we do. You know, nothing really to write home about. And so we live for and we have everything drawn toward that peak experience, toward that next significant moment as we have judged it to be. We're looking for outcomes, always looking for the outcomes and passing by. And the truth of the matter is that those details are our lives. We don't get any others. And when we get up to that significant moment and we step right into it, guess what? It's another regular moment like any other. And then we're looking for the next significant moment. And our whole lives can be spent in this sort of sleepwalking state, missing all the significant moments. We need to start to ground ourselves. But there's another side too, because the big ideas, what we believe, is going to affect the quality of those moments, the way we experience those moments. I've said it here before, and I'm going to say it several times today. The reality that we believe is the reality that we endure. Get that? Put it on your fridge. The reality we believe is the reality we endure. None of us really experiences reality directly. We experience it through the filter of what we already believe. The things we believe color the things that we experience. And so we need to question those things. We need to take a look at them. We need to take a look at these big ideas and these revelations as we think we have them, and start to take a look at how they're affecting our details. We're going on a vacation here, finally. Last week of August, we're heading up to Oregon. And believe it or not, we're going to take the train. 32 hours on a train. Why are we taking the train? Well, because our 15-year-old son can't stand long car drives, and he's ADD, and he just kind of goes bonkers, and he's afraid to fly. So what does that do for you? That gives you a circumference of about, 50 miles or something that you can, a radius that you can deal with here. So we decided, okay, we're going to go take the train. Let's see if we can do this. I tell my son, why don't you want to fly? Well, I'm afraid of heights. I said, but you're in the plane. We'll give you an aisle seat. You won't even know you're in the air. Oh, I'll know I'm in the air, What he believes about flying is keeping him from the experience of flying. What he believes about what he is going to be doing is changing the nature of that reality. And so it's changing the nature of our reality, too. 30 hours on a train, both ways. We did get a sleeper car, though, so it won't be so bad, I hope. But how often do we do this? How many relationships have you all sabotaged because you expected a certain outcome? Men always do this, so I'm going to do that. And women always, we do this all the time with our relationships, with our approach to jobs or to new things. We bring this experience from the past, what we think we know, what we think reality is, and it colors everything that we're doing. We need to check our assumptions. We need to check our premises and see what they are doing to the conclusions that we make. Are the conclusions really what's there in the moment? Or are we importing them in an improper way? That's what we need to talk about. Now, there's a really big idea that colors everything that Christianity is about. It's colored it for 2,000 years, and it colors it today. And this is our notion of the afterlife. This is our notion of heaven and hell. What we believe about heaven and hell has a huge, just profound effect on how we experience our lives. What we think about this whole process of living our lives. What we think about our faith. What we think of God. What you think about heaven and hell has this huge, huge effect, and you may not even be aware of it. And hell is the stronger of the two, because the fear of punishment is about the strongest human motivation. It's been used more effectively than any other. We've got the carrot and the stick. We've got reward, we've got punishment. The fear of punishment is very motivating. The church has used it all throughout its history to motivate people. And the irony is as Jesus told us, you're not going to get olives from a fig tree. Like breeds like. Fear breeds fear, and only fear, and more fear, as love breeds love and more love. You're not going to be scared into the arms of a loving God. Fear is not going to take you where you want to go. At some point, like an airplane can't get into orbit, you got to change vehicles. Physicists call it the quantum leap, where the electron seems to wink out of existence and then wink back in, or change its state in terms of its energy level, and there's no in-between. It just winks out and winks back. At some point, we've got to get off the fear track and make a quantum leap over to the love track. You can't sneak up on it, You can only get so far, and at some point, you find yourself standing on the edge of the precipice. And what are you going to do? If we haven't become the kind of people that are willing to take that leap, to just fall back into the arms of what? Who? If we can't at least get the first inklings that there really are arms there to catch us, then we will never be able to make that leap. And a life lived in fear is characterized by fear. I have so many people tell me, but I'm not afraid. And I've said this before. Okay. Are you stressed? Well, yeah. Do you worry? Yeah. Are you angry? Do you yell at people when they cut you off on the freeway? Yeah, yeah. Envious, jealous, depressed. Do you need something to go to sleep? Yeah. Do you need something to wake you back up? Yeah. Where do you think all of that comes from? Every one of those is a symptom, a branch of the tree of fear. Fear is at the root. If you want to find out what's going on in your life whenever you're experiencing something negative, ask yourself the same question. What am I afraid of? It'll take you like a laser to the source of your problem. What am I afraid of? Am I afraid I'm not going to get what I want that someone else has? Envy. I'm afraid I'm going to lose what I already do have? Jealousy. I'm afraid that things are just going to always continually block what I need? Anger. It's coming from fear. Fear is the little death. Fear is the thing that we are all dealing with if we haven't made this quantum leap over to love. And the fear of hell, this existential fear that we have, wondering what that unknown transition is at the moment of death and where we end up and what the criteria for that is, that unknowing, that wondering if there is a God that we are trying to follow that would put us in such a place as hell and throw away the key. How do we resolve that in a relationship? I counsel married couples, and I hear them throwing about the D word, divorce. What does that do to a marriage? What does that do to a relationship? If the dissolution of that relationship, if the end game is being talked about when you're still trying to work on just relating to each other. As soon as you bring up the specter of complete abandonment, how do you trust? How do you connect? Well, this is God. God is different. Yeah, God is different. But we're the same. How are we as human beings going to relate to God if it's not like the way we relate to everybody else? We're still us. We're still trying to do this relational thing through human vehicles. And our relationship with God feels like relationship with each other. We understand that it's qualified different, but it's going to feel the same. And so if we think that God is going to cut us off, if there is a time limit to his love, that unconditional love is only good to a certain point, then it's still performance after all. Our notion of hell needs to be looked at, because everything Jesus was about, the one message, and he was a Johnny One Note, one message over and over and over again was to show us who his Father was. And he said, if you want to know, look at me. Look at how I love. Listen to the stories that I tell you of a love that never quits, a love that never, ever gives up. And then you'll start to know something about my Father and about this love. He called it good news. Is there good news if there's a time limit? Is there good news if we can be left and abandoned? I know I'm pushing right up against all the Christian theology. Stay with me for a while, though, and let's see what we can come up with. I wanted to read you a couple of things. Some other views on heaven and hell that I thought were pretty good. This one has been out there on the internet for quite some time, and you may have read it before, but I saw it and I just loved it. It goes like this. Heaven is where the police are British, the cooks are French, the mechanics are German, the lovers Italian, and it's all organized and run by the Swiss. Right? Hell is where the police are German, the cooks are British, the mechanics French, the lovers Swiss, and it's all organized and run by the Italians. And then I found one that added, in heaven, the teenagers are Japanese and the movie makers are American. And in hell, the teenagers are American and the movie makers are Japanese. I thought that was pretty good, too. You know, it's interesting to me, something like this. It's funny and, it's picking fun at our European friends here and ourselves, I suppose. But it has an analog in what the ancient Hebrews thought about heaven and hell as well. Now, why do we care what the ancient Hebrews thought? Well, as I pointed out so many times, Jesus was an ancient Hebrew. Yeah, but Jesus was more than just a Hebrew, right? He was God. He was our Savior. True, but he was talking to Hebrews in their language, through their own worldview, through their culture, through their understanding. So when he uses words, if he doesn't take the time to redefine them, then whatever image is painted in their mind through their culture, understanding, and worldview is all right with him. Jesus spent pretty much his whole ministry trying to redefine law and redefine kingdom. But when he used the words that have been translated as hell, he let them stand. So what they understood about those words was okay with him. You know, I just had several people in the last couple of weeks tell me that they were shocked that Jesus didn't speak English. They thought he spoke English. Actually, he didn't, you know. I know. But you know, he has been so anglicized, he's been so westernized, that we don't realize that he didn't speak English. You know, that English is a language that would even be reckoned. In fact, Old English, which started around 750 AD, that's almost 800 years, 700 years after the crucifixion, you wouldn't even be able to understand that today. It's not for another 400 years or so before Middle English becomes something we can even read today. So English is a relatively young language. Jesus spoke either Hebrew or Aramaic, with most scholars saying it was probably Aramaic. And so what the Jews thought about heaven and hell does count, because Jesus was speaking into that worldview without making corrections. And to the Jews, tell you what, they don't really think much about the next life. Olam Haba, as they call it, the world to come. To them, that's God's domain, and all we need to do is what we're supposed to do here and now. To a Jew, their task, their job, was to live between heaven and earth. Through their lives, to bring the connectedness of heaven to earth and to bring the individual and independent experience of earth to heaven, to merge the two. Whatever happened in the next life, that was God's domain. You take care of your job here and now, everything will be fine, because God is just and merciful and everything will be all right. So Jews to this day don't really have any doctrine of the afterlife, but they have a lot of folk stories. One of them is that in heaven, one story teaches, Moses sits and teaches Torah all day long. For the righteous people, this is heaven. For the evil people, it's hell. Another folk tale teaches that in both heaven and hell, human beings cannot bend their elbows. In hell, people are perpetually starved. In heaven, each person feeds his neighbor. And there's a longer take on this that a medieval rabbi wrote and used as part of his teaching. And I want to read it to you because it kind of fills this notion out. This is Rabbi Chaim, who was an itinerant preacher. He traveled from town to town delivering religious sermons that stressed the importance of respect for one's fellow man. He often began his talks with the following story. I once ascended to the firmaments, he says, and that's in Hebrew cosmology, that's going into the multiple layers of heaven. I first went to see hell, and the sight was horrifying. Row after row of tables were laden with platters of sumptuous food, yet the people seated around the tables were pale and emaciated, moaning in hunger. As I came closer, I understood their predicament. Every person held a full spoon, but both arms were splinted with wooden slats so he could not bend either elbow to bring the food to his mouth. It broke my heart to hear the tortured groans of these poor people as they held their food so near but could not consume it. Next, I went to visit heaven. I was surprised to see the same setting I had witnessed in hell. Row after row of long tables laden with food, but in contrast to hell, the people there in heaven were sitting contentedly talking with each other, obviously sated from their sumptuous meal. As I came closer, I was amazed to discover that here too each person had his arms splinted on wooden slats that prevented him from bending his elbows. How then did they manage to eat? As I watched, a man picked up his spoon and dug into the dish before him. Then he stretched across the table and fed the person across from him. The recipient of this kindness thanked him and returned the favor by leaning across the table and feeding his benefactor. I suddenly understood. Heaven and hell offer the same circumstances and conditions. The critical difference is in the way the people treat each other. I ran back to hell to share the solution with the poor souls trapped there. I whispered in the ear of one starving man, "You do not have to go hungry. Use your spoon to feed your neighbor, and he will surely return the favor and feed you." "You expect me to feed the detestable man sitting across the table?" said the man angrily. "I would rather starve than to give him the pleasure of eating." I then understood God's wisdom in choosing who is worthy to go to heaven and who deserves to go to hell. This idea of God's choosing, of course, is a euphemism. As we said, in many are called, few are chosen. As many are called, few choose to be chosen. The idea here is that we are doing the choosing. It's our ability to see each other, as connected, to care about the other enough that changes our attitudes, changes our reality. This is true here and now. How many of us are living in a self-imposed hell because of what we believe? That keeps us there. What we believe keeps us separated, keeps us seeing the worst in everything, keeps us feeling like victims, where in the exact same circumstances, another person is experiencing the heaven, the greatest moments of their lives. It's not the circumstances that dictate our experience. It's what's going on interiorly. In the Christian tradition, C.S. Lewis, of all people, speaks a lot about this issue. In an essay called The Problem of Pain, he writes, "And here is the real problem. There's so much mercy, and yet there's still hell. But hell was not made for men. It is in no sense parallel to heaven. I willingly believe that the damned are, in one sense, successful rebels to the end, that the doors of hell are locked on the inside. I do not mean that the ghosts may not wish to come out of hell in the vague fashion where an envious man wishes to be happy. But they certainly do not will even the first preliminary stages of that self-abandonment through which alone the soul can reach any good. They enjoy forever the horrible freedom that they have demanded and are therefore self-enslaved. Just as the blessed, forever submitting to obedience, become through all eternity more and more free. This man in hell, he has his wish to live wholly in the self and to make the best of what he finds there. And what he finds there is hell." This is that idea, again, just taken a step further, that it is we who choose the circumstances that we find ourselves in. He wrote another short book called The Great Divorce, which he kind of took this idea and turned it into an allegory for a man who wakes up and finds himself in this gray city, which is kind of like the city he left, but it's drab and it's just depressed, and there is no real joy there, no real color there. But he's able to board a bus that takes him to heaven. And he's given the opportunity to stay there if he wants. And everyone aboard the bus is given the opportunity to stay in heaven and not have to return to the gray city that, of course, they don't even yet realize is hell. But almost all of them make excuses and get back on the bus and go back. It's hard for us to understand. We think, of course, if I were given the choice, I would know what choice to make. But even if we want to do something, are we really going to do it? There are so many of us that want to be fit, want to lose some weight. But how many of us actually start and maintain the diet or start and maintain the workout process? See, once again, we're thinking about outcomes and events. And we're forgetting that there's a process that leads up to that. When it comes right down to it, life is all process. Not event, not outcome. It's a process. You're either on the process or you're not. You're either on the way of Jesus or you're not. And the way of Jesus will take you someplace. But it's the process that changes us from the inside out. We're looking for outcomes to change us from the outside in, and it just doesn't work that way. We've got to change our thinking. We've got to move in new directions. And we have to be sensitive to all those little moments, all those little details along the way. In The Great Divorce, C.S. Lewis writes, "There are only two kinds of people in the end, those who say to God, 'Thy will be done,' and those to whom God says, 'Thy will be done.'" It's our choice. He writes, "If we insist on keeping hell, or even earth, we shall not see heaven. If we accept heaven, we shall not be able to retain even the smallest and most intimate souvenirs of hell." To be in the presence of God is so all-consuming that it displaces everything else. But whatever we're clinging to, that last thing that we hold on to is what keeps us from the all-consuming presence of our God. You know, we talked about God's will in here, and I've told you over and over again that I don't believe God's will is a what. It's not a specific thing. It's not an outcome. It's a how. It's a process. It's a way of living life. And heaven and hell are the same way. We think of heaven and hell as destinations, as places, as outcomes, as what's. But really, what all this wisdom is telling us and pointing us toward is that they are processes as well. They are ways of living. There are ways of relating that dictate the experience that we have. It's a changing of the way that we look at these things that is going to make the difference. But really what it comes down to is, what does Jesus say, huh? What does the Bible say? That's our authority. And what I want to do is take you through a few verses here. They're in your bulletins if you want to follow along. How many people would be surprised to hear, to know, that the word hell does not appear in the Bible anywhere? Does that surprise anybody? It's not there. You could look it up. Now, if you look it up in your English Bible, you may find it there. But what the word hell is translating is one of five words in either Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek. And all of those five words have their own understandings, their own concepts of what this afterlife is all about. But none of it relates to hell as we understand hell. The word hell in English, in Old English, comes from Anglo-Saxon roots that point all the way back to Proto-Germanic, you know. And Halja, in this Proto-Germanic language, was this place a lot like Hades, an undifferentiated place where all the dead went. It was like the grave. It literally means unseen. It was this unseen place. But it came so much later. The first time hell appears is around that 8th century. The words that are translated here are Sheol and Hades and outer darkness and Tartaru and Gehenna. These are the words that appear in the Bible, both Old and New Testaments. And if you look at Job 7:9, when a cloud vanishes, it is gone. So he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. This idea of Sheol literally means the grave or the pit. It doesn't have so much to do with an afterlife. It just has to do with the dead going down into the grave, the dead going down into this unknown place. And it's really not clear what goes on down there. Both the righteous and the unrighteous go to the same place. They go to Sheol. They all die. It's like in Ecclesiastes where Solomon's lamenting that no matter how righteous you are, or unrighteous, or wise, or foolish, everybody has the same end. They all go to Sheol. He says a live dog is better than a dead lion because they all go to the same place. And so there's this unclear idea about what's actually happening. One of the Psalms says is, who can praise you in Sheol, talking to the Lord? So there's this question about what the relationships are even about. Now, Sheol has an analog in Greek, which is Hades. So if you look at Matthew 16:18, I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. Hades in Greek literally also means unseen. And it's very much like Sheol. It's a place of shades, of shadows, of diminished vigor in life. No color. But everybody goes there. The righteous and the unrighteous together in the same place. And the key thing to understand about both Sheol and Hades is they're not permanent. They're way stations. They're temporary holding places before you move on to something else. And so it's a very different concept than the idea of heaven and hell as we understand it. Jesus also talks in Matthew 22:13. And several times in the Gospels about outer darkness. Then the king said to his servants, bind him hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Sounds pretty bad. In Hebrew cosmology, they imagined a flat earth with the hard dome of the sky, which they called a rakia, which was like a pounded metal bowl inverted, and resting on mountains that ringed the edges of the flat earth. Into that dome were fixed the stars and the other lights in the sky. to move beyond the mountains that held up the sky, the Rakia, would be in the outer darkness. It was understood as a place that was outside of community, outside of light and heat and warmth and anything that could sustain life. When the scapegoat is sent out of the city walls, when someone who is unclean is sent out of the city walls, that was tantamount to death, tantamount to the outer darkness, because outside of community in these cultures, you would die. The only way you could stay alive was within community. That's why Jesus uses outer darkness when someone is being thrown out of the wedding feast into the streets, into the outer darkness. They're leaving everything that sustains life, that promotes unity and connectedness. It's literally the separation that is sin. But it's still not hell. It's not a permanent place. It's a place that you go to because you aren't following the conventions that would keep you in community. Then we have these other two, Tartarus, or as it appears in the New Testament, Tartaru, and only one time in the whole Bible, and this idea of Gehenna, which appears quite a lot. At 2 Peter 2:4, "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into Tartaru and committed them to the pits of darkness reserved for judgment," cast them into Tartaru. The idea of Tartaru, it was the bottommost compartment of Hades. And it was really reserved for the Titans and for the other enemies of Olympus. It was for gods and demigods and the Titans. And notice that Peter uses it in the same way. This is the place where the angels go. There's some English scholars that believe that Tartarus or Tartaru, as used in Christian context, was only reserved for angels and not for humankind. And it's the only one that has the sense of some permanency, of the angels going there and not getting out. The analog of Tartarus is Gehenna. Gehenna is what Jesus uses most often. Here at Matthew 5:29, "If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into Gehenna." Or as it would be translated, most likely in English, most often, into hell. Now Gehenna is interesting, because Gehenna actually refers to the Valley of Hinnom, which was off the city wall of Jerusalem. In the time of the patriarchs, it was the place where the Canaanites sacrificed to the god Molech, which was often child sacrifice. So it was a place of weeping and wailing and of these absolutely brutal atrocities. Fasting forward, after the Hebrews have taken over Canaan and have made it their own kingdom, it became the garbage dump where the refuse of the city was thrown. So organic matter, inorganic matter, fires were kept burning 24/7 to continually consume the cadavers and the other rotting materials so as not to cause any pestilence or sickness. But imagine what such a place would be like. A garbage dump that was continually on fire. A garbage dump where things weren't buried, they were just burned. So the fires, the smoke, the stench, the flies, the pestilence. For a Jew who believes in ritual cleanliness, this was the most despicable place that you could even imagine or ever imagine. But the important thing to understand about the fires of Gehenna is that they were there to purify. They were there to burn away disease. They were there to reduce the unclean thing to something that was clean, to mere ash. When the Jews talk about Gehenna in this context, when they're using it now, they're using it in the sense much more like Catholic purgatory than our hell. It's a place of purification. It's a temporary place that people go who have unfinished business in this life, who have not gotten to the place where they can go directly into what they call the Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. The place of paradise. When Jesus turns to the thief on his right side and says, "Today you will be with me in paradise," that would translate in Hebrew as Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, the complete unity with God. And so there is this place that was temporary. And according to Jewish tradition, the maximum stay in Gehenna was 12 months, 1 year. And of course, the 12 is a symbolic number. It's the number of a complete circuit, a cycle. It's like you were there until you came to completion, this idea of 12 months. In the Kaddish, the prayer for the dead that the Jews would ritually say for their children for a period of 1 to 3 months, but for their parents, you would say the Kaddish for your parents a maximum of 11 months. Why 11 months? Because if you said it for 12, you would be implying that they were as bad as they could possibly be and had to stay the whole time. Bad to the bone. And so you said it for 11 months. But here's the understanding. Everybody knew what Gehenna was. When Jesus uses that term, in their minds, it's painting this purgatory place. The place where the fires, yes, they burn, and yes, they punish, but their purpose is to purify. Their purpose is to make ready for moving on. And it's a temporary place. Very different than the picture that is painted in our minds of a permanent place of punishment, torture, and damnation forevermore without any hope of reprieve or appeal. Very different. What kind of hope is there in the second message? Well, we got to get it all right then. You know, I'll be okay because Jesus is my Lord and Savior. But what? I don't know about that guy. And here we go, you know, trying to figure these things out. Who's in, who's out, by what criteria? And then everybody has different criteria, you know? And maybe I'm not following the right Jesus, so I'm still going to go to hell. But I'm trying to, but maybe not. The kind of neurotic, schizophrenic kind of tendencies that come out of living life in this kind of fear, in this kind of hell, is exactly what Jesus came to try to dispel, to try to take us away from, to show us that we don't have to worry about such things. Now, as I say things like this, this is where I get into trouble, and I admit it. People start to think that I am a universalist. People start to think that I am saying that everyone is resolved to God. There was a book that came out recently. The title was Love Wins. I don't know, some of you might have read it. And the premise of the book is that love wins. God's love is always going to win out. God's love is always going to have the desired effect, and it's going to bring people into his orbit. I can't say that. I know that love wins. What I can say is that I know that love never gives up. There is never a moment that God stops drawing us, but there may well be a moment that we stop listening, that we stop responding. That like those ghosts of C.S. Lewis in hell, there may be even the desire slightly to move into a new place, but not the willingness, not the ability to actually engage in the process that's going to take us there. What is it that changes, that gets us to the place where we can start to understand this? Do you see why this matters, though? If we can't get to the point that we can absolutely trust God's love, how is it that we're going to live lives that reflect the freedom that Jesus was talking about? The freedom and the ability to completely give ourselves away. When the fear would hold it close, the fear would hoard it, the fear would want to draw those defensive walls around ourselves. Wednesday nights we've been studying Brother Lawrence in the practice of the presence of God. And here was a man who, through his life and through his process, became deeply and intimately acquainted with God's presence. He practiced it day in and day out. He understood that in his office, in his job and duties as the cook in his particular house, he still was as profoundly or more profoundly present to God's Spirit than he would be at chapel in front of the Blessed Sacrament. And this day-by-day abandonment to God and to his connection with him drove into the depths of his spirit this understanding that there was this unbreakable bond that he had with his God, who was everywhere, everywhere. There was no place he could go that God didn't precede him. And he found a way to be able to connect to that presence in all of his moments, no matter how boring, no matter how distasteful. God was with him, transforming the moment. I want to read to you what he said as he was on his deathbed. He was dying a painful death of pleurisy, agonizing each breath as he took, knowing that his death was coming. But as his eulogizer writes, The firmness of his, Brother Lawrence's, hope was no less evident. His courage was so great in a passage where there is everything to fear that he said to one of his friends who was questioning him about it that he feared neither death nor hell nor the judgments of God nor all the efforts of the devil. He could actually see the devil circling his bed, but he mocked the devil. He pushed his abandonment upon God so far that, forgetting himself and considering only God and the accomplishments of his will, he said repeatedly, "Yes, if by any remote chance one could love God in hell and he wished to place me there, I would not be concerned about it, for he would be with me and his presence would make it a paradise. I have abandoned myself to him. He will do with me according to his pleasure." Think about that for just a second. This is amazing. Here is a man who learned to be present to God in all of his moments to such an extent that he didn't even fear if he were sent to hell, because even there he knew he would still want his God, and he would find him there, and that hell would be transformed into paradise, into Gan Eden. Heaven and hell are not these static places in these people's understanding. They move with our understanding of who we are in our God. It is possible to turn the hell of your days right now into the paradise, into the Gan Eden of heaven, if we simply find this connection and find this presence. And practicing that through our lives, we take it into the next life with us. We don't need to fear a judgment, because the gates are locked from the inside. We bring our sensibility to it. Look, I'm not trying to tell you what to believe. Believe me, that's not it. I don't want to try to direct what you believe, and I don't know what you're thinking about what I'm saying. What I'm trying to do is to maybe soften up the soil a little bit about what you think about these issues, so that you can start to look at maybe a different way that you can approach the process of your life, that you can start to dismantle maybe some of the fears that you have. Use your fears as the barometer of the quality of your relationship with God and with each other. If you are continually stressed, if you are depressed, if you are having such problems with resentments and jealousies and envies, and if you have to take medicine just to be able to cope, you know, some of that's going to be clinical, but some of that is going to be the result of the action of this fear on your life. To start to dismantle, starting from the big ideas, to let it come down into the details of your life, is this way of Jesus. It's what the prayer life engenders. It's what this life is all about. As we follow him, our perfect example, our way shower, our Savior, who fearlessly went all the way to the cross for our sakes, as part of something larger than himself, saying that we could do these things that he did and greater things than these, it is possible for us to do so if we can start to grasp these things. Once I read 1 John 4:16-19, I didn't know how I could ever think anything other than what I'm telling you right now. And yet it's been there for 2,000 years in the mix, and somehow we miss it. But John writes, "We have come to know and have believed that the love which God has for us." Let me read that again. "We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love. And the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this, love is perfected with us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment. Because as he is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. We love because he first loved us." God is love. He doesn't do it. He is it. The only way we can do it at all is because he is that thing that we are emulating. He is love. He is forgiveness. He is redemption and salvation and healing. He is those things. When we approach him, when we bring him into our moments, or better, when we bring ourselves into his moments, that's what we experience. It's never anything else, because God is those things, all of them at the same time. We don't need to fear hell, because we won't be held there against our will. Thomas Merton's famous prayer about desire. I don't know where I'm going, Lord. I don't know your will. I wouldn't know it if I was even on it. But I do desire to please you, and I know that that desire is in and of itself pleasing to you. Even if it gets down to that baseline, we are still in the center of God's will. Questioning the big ideas is only the first step. Whatever you come away with, and I hope that at least you'll think about these issues, all I can tell you is what I'm convinced of. You need to go become convinced of what you're convinced of. And we may well be convinced of different things. But if those different things and those different big ideas allow us to live our lives as Jesus lived his, then there's nothing broken, and we don't need to fix it. Because what Jesus was trying to get us to do was to live the how, to live our lives in such a way that we were indistinguishable from him and therefore from his Father. When that is accomplished, when we are living in kingdom, there is nothing else to be said. And anything else said is just commentary. So I will stop now and let's pray. Father, help us. In our weakness, these things are so difficult to do. In our weakness, we fear everything around us. We are literally children in the dark looking for hands to hold. Help us to find your hands. Help us to hold on tight. Help us to put our stake down at the point of your love and to understand our reality, everything that happens to us, from that point of view and not from any other. Help us to hold on to you and your love for dear life, because that is our salvation. Thank you for your Son who gave his life, opening this door, opening this way, literally connecting us to you. Help us to make the choice to walk through. Thank you, Father, for who you are. We love because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.